Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hello, welcome to the Akot Disney podcast, where we have a look at all the secrets hidden behind the mouse. As always, this is Matt here, joined today by the satanic skeleton mouse, I guess. Or do you have a better name for your get up right now?
I'm just Paranoid American. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, okay.
My name's Thomas from ParanoidAmerican.com. That's it.
Oh, you got a haircut then.
That's right. I did.
Okay, that makes sense. And then since it's Orlando, everyone grows mouse ears eventually. I get it.
I got back from the park during a hurricane. I got hit by lightning while I was on one of the rides. Like a big thing happened. I was holding like a enchanted token, apparently, some kind of a totem.
Ooh, that jewel that used to be in the great movie ride, maybe. Wasn't that cursed? They'll do it.
Yeah, but apparently the antidote is on Little St. James, but unfortunately I can't get access to that anymore.
I know. Yeah. Where are we today? We are now, I guess we're hitting fully modern Disney. It's an old movie at this point, but it just feels very still modernish, I guess. The Little Mermaid, it's the modern spell of Disney. Should we say that?
Yeah, I mean, when we were watching it, I definitely felt older because I remember when it came out and then seeing, okay, 89, not too recent, not too old, but the animation, it looks classic now compared to any animation I've seen in the last three decades almost. It definitely had, you know, it shows its age in a good way, though, in a good and maybe a bad way.
Yeah, this is the last animated Disney movie done on cells. I think DuckTales does too, but that's not like mainline, right? That's kind of the side of Disney animation. But after this is when they go fully digital. So the coloring becomes all digital. They start using the caps system, all that sort of thing.
Getting hot. It was getting hot under there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I also realized my headphones weren't even on. So I had this extra complication for no reason. There you go.
Yeah, I was like rambling like slightly longer than I meant to about the this being the last cell drawn movie. So yeah, it mostly does go digital after this point. At this point, when I was reading up on the production, just as far as animation things, it also said mentioned this was the most bubbles they'd had to animate since Fantasia, and they outsourced those to China. So. Not Korea, really, China.
The bubbles. There's a lot of like smoke effects and fluid effects in this one too. So it was interesting. I liked it. And there was a lot of like effects. Lightning effects and like the lightning jumping around through the clouds and stuff. And it was a nice blend of, I assume a lot of that was done digitally, like kind of in post, but it was a nice blend between the two.
Yeah, a lot of the hazy effects. So this is an interesting, I guess this is the most hybrid of Disney's movies where it really does have like half of it, you know, big chunk of its analog, a big chunk of it's starting to get kind of digital. For 80s, it's a lot of digital. Yeah.
I mean, but at this point, it's classic enough that it almost feels like, we'll just put it in the analog bucket. Like, we're just going to put this in the traditional animation bucket, even though for the time it was pretty digital and, you know, forward thinking
and like futuristic almost, but now it's not. So now it's just classic Disney animation.
I don't remember seeing this for the first time. I mean, I was 10 when it came out, I guess, but I don't know when I first saw it. It's kind of weird. I guess it's one of those things where you probably saw bits and pieces at like, you know, elementary school parties and stuff, and just had to piece the movie together over like a year or two. Cause
I'm positive that I've seen it start to end, but it was probably cause like I was babysitting or getting babysat or something. I was probably getting like, it was probably like a babysitting related thing.
No, I've seen this movie several times. I have it on DVD. The DVD is in the player, but in the end I got lazy and watched it on my computer, but DVD's in the player. So could have done it that way. Also, I wanted to, you know, just crank up the speed a little bit because it was getting late at night.
this one's not a bad one to watch at like 1.5, maybe even 2.
Yeah, yeah. But you got the songs, of course, which sound a little silly if you're playing at that speed, but you can handle that sort of thing. But yeah, I did the DVD in here is the really bare basic one that came out in 97, 99. And I wonder if that's the first time I watched it in its entirety. Of course, I have a daughter. So when she was a kid, we watched it a few times. She went off to see the new version at the theater last month. And I did, as I said, I got my viewing of that in and was basically like, you don't need to watch it, especially for anything like meaning or symbolism. I mean, there's that probably some of that modern day, you know, Disney stuff you could find in the live action one. But I think the core stuff is all in the animated one. So we're good to go with this one. And I'll reference it a few times as we roll on.
Okay. And I'm curious what your daughter thought.
Oh, I did ask her a few days ago. I was like, did you like the one you saw in the theater or the animated one? Without hesitation, she said animated. So
she knew she had to, otherwise, you know, she wouldn't have been sleeping outside for a week or something. Right.
She's got pretty good taste in movies. She wanted to watch like Hitchcock films. She wanted to see like the, you know, the old school Indiana Jones films, that sort of stuff. So, she's got enough of a taste for movies to kind of get it, I think.
Now we'll get there once we work it through animation, because now Indiana Jones is all Disney too, right? So now we got an excuse to go through those and observe for a cult symbolism. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And the new one the actors are fine. What is it? Javier Bardem, or am I saying his name right? Plays Trident. You know, he's fun. I actually kind of missed seeing him when I watching the animated one again, because he's got his gravitas. The girl who's Halle Bailey. It's so close to Barry, right? It's confusing.
They're trying to program us MK Ultra related.
Yeah, really. She's fine. They're like, oh yeah, we have a big star in this movie. That's not. I mean, I guess she is because she did the movie and it's successful. But the guy that plays Prince Eric, I don't remember his name. He was fine, you know.
He seemed way too
much older.
Well, okay. So I was about to ask, did they disclose the ages in the live remake? Because when I was taking, I haven't seen the live remake, but I know it exists, obviously. And as I'm making these notes in the movie, they explicitly mention that Prince Eric just turned 18. He's a legal adult. And that Ariel is 16. And the first thing I thought was like, ooh, that would be a weird one to immediately, you know, bring that translation over to the live action. So now you've basically got, you know, something that would get you put on a list if you were to actually pursue it outside of the movie.
I don't think they say that. I think they might still say Ariel's 16 in the new one, but let's see. I'm looking at the actors. Halle Bailey, it's hard to say her name, is like 23. Okay. I mean, right now she's 23.
Right. And but we're talking about the story here, but like the actual plot line.
Oh yeah. I'm just wondering about the new movie. Sorry. I'm having a brain tangent. It's a 5-year age difference in the live action one and the move and the animated one. Yeah. It's 16, 18, which I don't know, in a older society, I guess that's fine. Yeah, it seems weird now, right? It's like the college freshman dating a high school freshman, which is kind of weird.
And I think the other part, too, is some of the dated aspects. So when, you know, 1989 movie and it starts out and I had a note like, man, this movie is white, like white, like every single merfolk, right? They basically, it's the same, you know, white chick just with like different colored hair and different colored scales.
Peter Pan.
Yeah, there is like zero diversity under the sea, which is ironic because usually you think is, you know, under the sea is where there's lots of diversity.
Where it is white to zero diversity. Yeah, that should have been Sebastian's song, I guess. Here's one weird thing. Like, it never occurred to me watching the animated one that this is like a tropical colony sort of thing, which the new one does make clear that Prince Eric is living in like a tropical colony. I mean, I guess I just never really thought too hard about where Prince Eric was, but the new one definitely makes it clear this is probably Caribbean or something, which cool. I mean, the music should have been a tip off. I first saw it when I was 10. So, you know, maybe I've never assessed this movie like completely improperly till, you know, we are doing it now.
Well, because this is a cult Disney and because of recent events and everything, I can't watch this movie and not imagine it's off the coast of Little St. James. And that the entire premise here is that they're grooming this girl to go and get whisked away by this prince that lives in a castle. Right. And it feels so much like, I don't know. I don't want to say too much about it, but it's weird at this point just because of the premise of the movie itself, the background of the movie, but also, yeah, that tropical aspect and the fact that there's connections between Ghislaine and between, you know, Jeffy and other Disney related aspects to this.
Yeah, I don't know if Katzenberg is one of the guys that was hanging out there, but it seems like everybody like at least had a short vacation or something. So,
and I looked it up. I mean, on a tangent, I'll just spit out the highlights instead of the tangent aspect. But there's some pictures of Ghislaine Maxwell doing like a Disney event. Apparently, it wasn't that she was working for Disney or employed by Disney. It happened in like '86 or something, so it would have been before Little Mermaid. She also claims that she didn't meet Epstein until like after like 98 or something. So it was after this movie came out, like a decade or something like that. But she's loosely connected to Disney there because she did a Save the Children fundraising drive, which is kind of creepy in its own right. And you can find the original images on the mirror because she was actually working for the mirror at the time. But yeah, so I mean, I was trying to do some digging between the Ghislaine connection, because right after she leaves that, right after she meets Epstein, he buys Little St. James. That's pretty much what happens immediately. And then she gets deep into ocean research. She had like this whole, like, I forgot the name of it, but it was some kind of nonprofit international global organization where they did something about like sea research. So anyways, I'll save you all the extra tangents, but I was watching this whole movie through that kind of lens a little bit.
Yeah, I guess mine was a little nicer. Just in that as we were talking earlier, I was very much in my daughter just watched this thing. So I told you she saw the live action one, and the next three times she went out, she went, you know, was wearing a dress, which, like I said, was kind of different. I think she's back to not wearing dresses around. So,
I mean, like, what, seeing the original animation or the live remake?
The live remake, which does feature a scene of Ariel going around in a very nice, like, blue dress.
Okay.
Yeah. I wonder if blue has anything, you know, because it's blue in this one, too. So,
it's primary color. It's kind of hard to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, Cinderella, it's a blue dress. I don't know. I'm just sitting here now, you know, devil with a blue dress on. I don't know, that sort of thing.
I've heard recently this was an interesting concept, but that like white, orange, yellow colors come from the sun, so they are like these extraterrestrial energies. But that blue comes from the earth, so it's like this terrestrial energy, and that's why there was all these reports of the old gods from different cultures being blue skinned. It was just some random note that came up recently that I thought was really interesting.
Blue bloods, all that. Yeah. My mother would drive me crazy when I was a kid, cause I'd want to wear like, say like an orange shirt. And she would be like, you're a winter. You're not a summer. You can't wear that. So, cause she'd gone to some kind of meeting where they explained how these are winter colors and these are spring colors, and people and their skin tones and hair make them a winter or a summer or something. So,
oh, so it wasn't like an astrological thing. It was like, I don't know.
It was just, I mean, it sounded like an astrological thing.
Sounds,
yeah, but
like
it was it, basically, yeah. Basically, no, it was a fashion thing. So it might, who knows, maybe it was astrological and just got watered down by the time my mom heard it. So I mean, that's how a lot of these things work, right?
Yeah.
But where were we? Yeah, I guess I just should say for the effects of this movie, another thing is I was at the school I work at yesterday, and there's about, you know, there's like 8, 6, or 7 year old kids. We're waiting for class, doing check tests. Four of them are girls, and all of them had at least one piece of Ariel merch about them. One of them had the water bottle with Ariel
working
straight as the t-shirt. You know, everyone's got like something, and it's all the animated one. I even noticed at the movie theater, because Japanese theaters sell a bunch of you know, like merch at the theaters, and it was all animated, even though it was promoting the new movie.
Well, we've talked about this a few times, that there's a very good chance that Disney just pumps out the anime or the live action remakes, knowing that they might be inferior or seen as inferior, and they still sink the money into it because it gives them a whole other reason to resell all the ancillary goods from the original movie. That, and then, you know, you put those out, and of course you're going to see her on cups. You're probably going to see like sneakers and t-shirts, and like, it's a whole revival of the new and the old. But I feel like they bank on the old more so than the new.
And the Japanese ones maybe get like a little weirder, like maybe 2 or 3 years ago in a kindergarten class, there's some girl, her water bottle had Ariel with the phrase "mermaid hair don't care." And I still haven't worked out what that means.
Oh, you've never heard that before?
I never heard that. Okay. Cause she cares about her hair. She's got her fork and everything.
No. That's okay. So I think that there's another version of that. It's like horse hair don't care. And it's basically like, I've got beautiful horse hair, so I don't care what you've got to say about me. So mermaid hair don't care is like, I'm so styling. Like, you can't even talk to me right now. Like, I don't even care about what you have to say because my hair is so nice.
See, I just got an image of like a super dumpy looking Ariel, right? Just going off in all directions, that sort of thing.
Well, that's Ursula then.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Or,
well, she's got that crop cut.
Well, I don't want to just be like, it's common knowledge, but yeah, that's basically kind of sort of based on, you know, Divine from John Waters movies, which I'm a big John Waters fan. So I definitely like that.
You have to explain this to me a little bit.
John Waters is a film director.
Yeah. I know the guy, right? Because he's got like the very unique silhouette and face. What movie are you talking about?
Several movies.
Is it Splash? Splash is one of them, right?
Oh no, this is different. These are schlock films, right? In the 70s, John Waters made these like midnight movies, you know, like totally disgusting, very funny, but truly disgusting. And his lead actor was was Divine, who was a very large man who did drag, basically. And starred in
okay, I think I vaguely know what you're talking about now. Like, I got the image of the guy.
The original Hairspray is the only place where Divine like really hits the mainstream a little bit, because after that, Divine died shortly after. And John Waters is never, I mean, he would make studio films after that point, but he was never like he's definitely for the caught edge, you know.
Is Ursula definitely Divine, or is that just like a fun cult thing? Or is there?
That's who they base the character on.
And, interesting. If
you watch 70s Divine, a movie like Pink Flamingos or something, which be read, you know, not safe for work to the extreme, but great. I saw it in the theater actually with John Waters doing a lecture at the University of Georgia, and there was an intermission. And right before the intermission, you see the singing asshole. So after the intermission, half the crowd was gone.
And then the real movie starts.
Yeah.
So is this the first Disney animation with a starring drag queen?
Well, Divine's not doing the voice. They just based the character on a drag queen. Yeah,
I mean, which potato, tomato.
Yeah. Which made me like, I mean, there's so much. So there you go. Disney, they cast Melissa McCarthy as Ursula in the new one, which not cast like a good drag queen, you know, what Izzard or whatever, you know, somebody like that, you know, I mean, yeah, this one. And I
could have just picked from like the RuPaul, you know, Drag Race, right?
Exactly. Yes. I'm a staunch defender of the 2016 Ghostbusters film. I really like it, like almost as much as the original. But yeah,
wait, is this the all female one?
That's right. But Melissa McCarthy was not good in the New Mermaid. Yeah, I love the 2016 one.
There's something in the water there. That's all it is.
It touches on some brand of like exceptionally stupid humor that appeals to me. So, and I like the designs and stuff. So yeah,
simple things for simple minds. That's fine.
I know a lot of people do not like that one. So, I happen to be one of the. I also what's my other unpopular? Oh, I like Anchorman 2 a lot better than Anchorman 1. I agree.
And Anchorman 2 was made from like the rough cuts of just like random footage, I guess they strung together and made a movie out of. No.
Oh, they later made an actual Anchorman 2, like a fully like we made it 10 years later sequel.
Oh, I'm so behind.
Yeah, that you're talking about Wake Up Ron Burgundy, which is fun, right, but yeah, that's right. The outtakes one. But no, there's an actual Anchorman too, which I prefer. A lot of comedies, I prefer the sequels. I do not prefer The Little Mermaid to straight to video. That is not.
I haven't seen it before. I'm gonna have to look at it. It looks weird. She almost looks like Pocahontas on the cover, which is kind of strange.
Yeah, honestly, I haven't seen it either. I'm just assuming I like the old one better. So hey, maybe I. Could be wrong. Could be wrong. So
there's a few of these movies, man, that turn out to be fever dreams, like the direct to video ones, because they fly under the radar. And it feels like someone was like, this is going to be my vehicle for this weird message that I have to get out. And I understand that it's Little Mermaid 2, but I also have like, you know, this message from, I don't know, God or the demons or from somewhere. And it's like, it's going to come through this movie. And sometimes it comes through those weird direct to video movies.
Yeah, yeah. If we ever do run out of, you know, gas in the tank, I mean, we can look at some. But yeah, I wasn't ready. Well, we did all the Brave Little Toasters, didn't we? Those got quite bizarre.
And that one I'm happy with. I'm very happy that I ended up trucking through little Brave Little Toaster 2 and 3, because they are really like a fever dream. Like if you were to watch them and not have anyone there to back you up, and then like the file is gone or, you know, Netflix takes it down, it really does feel like a movie that you just dreamed up and that it wasn't an actual movie.
Yeah, for sure. So, I was not motivated to do The Little Mermaid 2 and 3, but I don't think they don't really have a notoriety for being particularly off the rails either.
We'll find out when we get there.
We could have missed out. So
that's right. No one else is really watching them for this particular type of context either. So as a movie on its own merit, it might not stand up, but there's lots of movies that once you understand how to watch it, they're more meaningful.
That's a good point. Florida parks have for the Little Mermaid these days? Don't they have a ride or something, or is that Disneyland?
I haven't been in such a long time. I don't even remember. I know that there's a lot of themed stuff in like an underwater. They had an underwater ride at some point, but who knows if it's still there. It might be problematic. You know what I mean? It might be problematic at this point.
What do we have in the Tokyo Disney Sea has like a Mermaid Land, which is kind of cool. It's all indoor, so if it's a gnarly weather day, you go in there. And mostly kind of smaller kids rides. I'll see if we can find an image actually. But then they have like a little, you know, 30-minute condensed live show with giant puppets and stuff, and that was pretty cool. So Tokyo does have some stuff. Again, that is a American property or Danish or whatever. That's a very popular here. So Japanese are into this. It's a worldwide spell in this case, you know. You'd be hard pressed to find a Japanese person who even knows what Oliver and Company are, but Little Mermaid, obviously no problem.
I didn't even know what Oliver and Company was, and I saw it when it came out. You know what I mean?
Maybe we should talk a little bit about the Anderson source material, Hans Christian Andersen, which the detail I remember mostly from that is it just being, well, she, you know, spoiler alert, the mermaid dies at the end. And also just disturbing details. Like when she has human legs, it's like, it feels like walking on broken glass when she walks. I'm like, wow, why do we even need to add that in? So much darker.
Well, because it shows how much she was willing to suffer for this ultimate goal. But so Like, I'm ready to get deep on this one. And to be honest,
I was kind of trying to send you down the log flume into that.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting out of all of the movies so far that Little Mermaid would have brought me into the places that it brought me. And I just want to start out with one word, one name, Paracelsus. And anyone that's familiar with I mean, if you're not, I don't blame you, because it's pretty like a cool esoteric name. But Paracelsus is, to some people, the like great grandfather of modern medicine. He was recognized out of many, many things that he acknowledged that there was a biological difference between men and women, so that they should be treated differently if they had problems. Again, that might be problematic in 2023, but it was actually a pretty beneficial advancement in medical knowledge as a whole back when he came up with this. I think this is like 16th century. And on top of that, he understood that plants actually had some kind of healing properties to them. And I think he's attributed to many quotes, but one of them is that the dose is the cure, something like this, where he understood in high doses, something could be poisonous, but in low doses, it could be helpful to you. Whereas I guess in like, you know, prior thinking, it was just like, if that thing killed somebody, then it's always bad, always avoid it. It's, you know, it's poison or it's black magic. So Paracelsus on one front is known for kind of being the originator to medicine and a lot of different ways, but he's also an alchemist, and he believed in demons and he believed in spirits and nymphs, and he was particularly fascinated with water nymphs. And he got his fascination from Martin Luther, where Martin Luther from, you know, like the Martin Luther from Lutheran, you know, Catholics, or not Lutheran Catholic, but Lutheranism.
Lutheran the Catholics.
Yeah, Luther Catholics. That's actually the new sect that I'm coming out with next year. That's Paranoid American Exclusive. But like, so Paracelsus and Lutheranism, they both describe these water nymphs, and they talk about them as if they were real. And there's ancient Greek historians that said at one point there was like 3,000 of them worldwide, and that they could live for thousands of years, but they just slowly began dying off. So I mean, it's really hard from the perspective that we look through some of these. And when I go back and read the mythology, like, was it always just a story? Did people actually believe this? Is it possibly real? One of the questions that I like asking people on paranormal interviews, if they believe in mermaids, because there's been so many documentaries on, you know, History Channel in the middle of the night. I'm like, is this a real mermaid skeleton? Did the merfolk exist? And it's because it is such an old and classic tale that's been repeated for close to, you know, 1,000 years at this point. And perhaps farther back, but we've got definitive evidence of it from around like the 1300s. So I don't want to give like an entire history lesson on here, but I've got like some highlights on it. So Martin Luther has a version where he talks about this entity called Melusine. I'm not sure what the exact pronunciation of it is, but Melusine is essentially the offspring of other gods, and she becomes this like half snake, half serpent, half lady. And in many retellings, it sometimes turns into a fish, but it's kind of like a shapeshifter. We're talking about a reptilian shapeshifter, literally. And I'm not like trying to weave that in just for the conspiracy angle. That was the original story as told by both Paracelsus and Martin Luther. So Paracelsus gets influenced by this, and he writes a whole bunch of books on elements, you know, earth elements and air elements and water elements. So I guess the sirens were kind of like an air element version of a mermaid, because they had the body of a bird and then like the top half of a woman. And those are the ones that would just kind of like yell at you, I guess. I mean, harpies, I think, are tangentially related to this, right?
But then you're screamy to the rocks. Yeah.
Right. And then the mermaids are the ones that use their voice, right? Their beautiful voice to lure the men to the rocks. We even see that in Peter Pan. In the Peter Pan, there's a small segment when they're clearly trying to like kill Wendy, you know, because that's what the traditional role of mermaids kind of was back then, or these merfolk, or this Melusine, is that they were there to kind of lure humans away. And this goes back way, way, way back further. So just follow me here. It goes back to the Watchers and the original You know, like the Nephilim, this was the angels that came down to Earth and they wanted to mate with human beings. And then through the mating of these fallen angels and the humans, they create these races of Nephilim, which are these big giants, right? And then through all the biblical tales and through time, you know, it starts out with like Gilgamesh being the offspring of Nephilim. But then over time, people keep getting smaller and smaller. So they're no longer these huge giants. They get littler and littler. But apparently during those times of giants, all of these other sort of non-human entities existed. And this is also the concept of like the Lilith, where the Lilith was a succubus that would attack women and children, or it would like come and steal your man in the middle of the night. And if Lilith had any sort of offspring with a human, they would turn into like beasts and creatures and demons and monsters and cryptids. Like that's where all of the weird sort of like things that go bump in the night came from. They came from Lilith and Adam, or Lilith and whoever else. So like all of this does connect 100% back to this merfolk, this Melusine character, which kind of again starts in like the 1300s, 1400s. Many different people are writing about it, and it essentially is like this lady that gets married to a king or a prince, and has to hide every Saturday, or like one day a week, or sometimes it's like every 3 days. There's different variations, but she has to hide herself because she turns back into this fish briefly, so you know she doesn't want to freak her husband out.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF, Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
So anyways, this dates back so freaking far. And when Paracelsus's name popped up, I got excited. I got real excited.
I'm sitting here curious with the Nephilim thing, and there's the kind of alternate track, which, you know, you hit all the same beats, but the whole Anunnaki vibe, how have you gotten deep on that sort of stuff?
A little bit, to be honest, man. I'm interested in it because other people are interested in it, but personally, I don't know. I kind of throw them all together. I don't want to disappoint too many people out there that are big into like Anunnaki and Nephilim and ancient aliens and stuff.
I guess that one appeals to me because what you're explaining is the mythological, you know, more magical based one, which is cool, right? I'm a sci-fi head. I like the Anunnaki one. So
Stargate,
So the Cliff Notes version would be you have this, you know, like the 12th planet rolling through the solar system and only crossing our plane every 3,000 years, right? And the folks that live there start a colony here to mine gold.
Yeah, this is like Zechariah Sitchin's work a little bit too.
Yeah, no, this is 100%. That's where what I'm dragging this from. So you got the actual aliens down in, you know, like the South Africa area that are just getting tired of working this hard and asking that they'd use the, you know, locals basically that would still be de-evolved hominids to do the work. So the scientists and these are gods, right? I didn't come in prepared.
And this is just like there, the humans in Snow White send the earth elementals back into the ground and get the riches, right? In exchange for wisdom.
But the part of the story that I kind of would tie in with the mermaids and why I'm bringing up this alternate version is you have Enki, or is he the? I think Enki's the more of the creator god, and kind of like our Triton, Poseidon, stand-in in the Anunnaki, and him and his wife, you know, doing actual genetic engineering to try and create this worker and making a lot of mistakes, you know, doing a Dr. Moreau style on the way. So something like a mermaid would be one of their failed attempts to create this replacement worker.
I wonder how scientific it was, or was it just like, you know, like you two get in that closet. Hey man and hey fish, you just get in that closet for 20 minutes and come back out.
People say mistranslated the tablets, blah, blah, blah. But they are talking basically about like mixing different, you know, fluids, you know, petri dish sort of stuff. So theoretically it was, I mean, you'd have to impregnate, you know, a willing Anunnaki at some point as well, which is also part of the story, but there's a fair amount of like sciencey science in it, you know?
Well, and so
whatever is there, science at least.
Well, and to tie that back to Paracelsus, that's another thing that Paracelsus was looking into. That was the homunculus concept, where you could just take the fluids of different beings and mix them up in a special way, and it would produce this other thing. I mean, Paracelsian monsters are essentially very similar to what people would claim that like Lilith could produce as offspring. So it's wild how closely it's related to like all this ancient alchemy and all these ancient tales, because Paracelsus and a lot of people up until I think like the 1500s or 1600s, they believed in magic, and they actually had a line between black magic and white magic. And I think it wasn't even on the books until one of the popes in like 1652 or something. I'm making some of these numbers up. But he was basically like, okay, now all magic's bad. But up until that point, a lot of people believed in white magic. And even Paracelsus, the father of medicine, he didn't understand microbiology or bacteria or viral infections. They really legitimately believed that these were demons that had to be kind of exorcised in and out. So you're coming from this area of like people know a little bit about medicine and a whole lot about mythology. And I think it's an interesting blend. Because we've kind of like flip-flopped it a little bit now.
Yeah, I was going to say at any given time, the line between magic and science is going to be in a different place, right? So, and especially if we do want to go with the gods or ancient aliens, then that line is going to be in a very weird place, right? So that's another part of the Stitchin thing where I told you we were watching Indiana Jones with my daughter and, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, which watching Raiders again, I was like, it was almost surprising how much of a kind of like reference to it it is. I think whoever wrote the script probably read some Sitchin. We were like, oh, it's a transceiver with.
I like it, man. I like the direction they've been taking them.
Melt your face off, you know, that sort of thing. So,
and the last one was like the whole place was like a huge alien spacecraft. Like, I'm in. I like it. I like that Indiana Jones is going the ancient aliens route more than ever.
Well, the Dial of Destiny does not, but that brings in the and I'm forgetting the name of the Greek navigating computer they found in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, I've actually been watching this. It's the Dial of Archimedes or something like this.
It's got a better name than that, but yes,
right. But it's like the oldest computer known to man, and it like predates advanced technology by 1,000 years. Like no, like. There's this thing that is so complex and so sophisticated, and then nothing even close to it for 1,000 years. And then all of a sudden people have technology again. So it's an interesting point. And it's a factual thing. Like this is a real thing. It was like an ancient computer of some kind.
Yeah. I think I saw it once. I think it was on display in Tokyo like 15 years ago for, you know, like,
Indy says that was a replica.
Okay, well, I saw the replica then. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, it looked cool. Well, 15 years ago, I didn't know what I was looking at anyway. I was just like, oh, that's cool.
But I want to keep going deep here. So, I'm gonna do a really quick overview, and I mean really quick, of like from Martin Luther to modern day, because you mentioned the Hans Christian Andersen one. So it's kind of starts more or less a little bit with Martin Luther's Table Talks. And then that influences Paracelsus. He writes about them. This in turn inspires, I'm going to get some names all messed up, Friedrich de la Motte Fouque's novella called Undine. And if you look, Undine is probably the closest thing to the original story of Little Mermaid as it begins to morph and change as it goes through. So it starts as Undine, 1811. That gets updated into a play called Undine, 1939. That then inspires Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale, 1837. And then it's also turned into a Russian opera called Rascala. And this is the same story, but it just kind of morphs as it goes between these different mediums. And then finally, it becomes like, you know, the Disney animation. But like you said, there's a huge discrepancy between some of these older versions and the Disney one. And there's another version that takes place in a forest where a young man meets this Melusina, this same water nymph, and she has a lower body of a snake. And the rule is that he has to kiss her three times on three consecutive days. And you can see where that comes into the Disney movie, where she has 3 days to get a kiss, but it has to be like the kiss of true love. And if she doesn't get it within 3 days, then she belongs to Ursula. And there's this whole extra plot line there. But this is a nugget that just has been very consistent with like the 3 days, which is obviously a very occult number, many different stories. But this thing with like the kiss and the true love. And as you said, it doesn't go well. And in fact, in that particular story, every day she gets progressively uglier. So the first day he kisses her, it's like not that big of a deal, right? But the second day she starts turning into like a horrific, you know, creature. And then the third day, it would be impossible to get like that third kiss. So she's kind of set up to fail. And the tragic end of it is that apparently mermaids don't have souls. They're just like these creatures, like a mechanical animal, like Rene Descartes might call them. And that's why they fall in love with humans, because if they have intercourse with a human and they breed and they have, half human children, their children will have souls. And there's even a chance that they themselves will have a soul. And I think we've talked about this in a few other previous episodes, like the Rosicrucian concept that if an animal spends enough time with a human, the human-esque like soul might rub off on them a little bit. So maybe dogs do go to heaven. So anyways, that's the very, very long-winded version of it, but it starts from this Melusine story, and it weaves its way into this tale about this weird creature that has no soul, perhaps because it was like a fallen angel that came to Earth, and that they're just trying to get a human soul again. And the Disney animation flips this on its head, but I'll get into that in a little bit. I need like a drink of water.
yeah, that was quite a bit. And I guess I'll go ahead and note at this point that this was something that was on the kind of on the Disney docket since 1939. One of the original ideas for their feature-length animation was to do an anthology of Hans Christian Andersen. They had a treatment for it and everything. This
would have been awesome to see a 1930s version of this.
Well, it's interesting because it was kind of like pitched in the mid-80s, and at first Katzenberg was like, we want to make Splash 2, which turned out to be an abject failure. But yeah, then they gave the go-ahead. They did a new treatment, and apparently when they found the old treatment after making the new one, and it was very similar. So the Disney sauce or spell or whatever was certainly...
Yeah, the formula.
What they did in 39 and what they did in like 86 or 87 was the beats were pretty much the same, apparently. So, I mean, having not read them both myself and just going by what the production,
maybe less steel drums, right?
Less steel drums. That was a late addition. Sebastian was going to be an English butler pretty far into the production until, you know, they brought in Mencken and Ashman, and they were like, hey, maybe we should like spice this up a little bit, which is probably a good choice. Won him an Oscar. Yeah. sorry, you had your water and you were midpoint there, I think.
that was the general premise of how it evolved from Martin Luther to Paracelsus all the way to Hans Christian Andersen. And the main beats about Hans Christian Andersen, just in case anyone's hasn't gone back and read the original source material. I mean, I never did until we did this. So like you said, she's given this potion and she drinks it. But as she drinks the potion, it's made to make her feel like there's a sword being passed through her body. And that once she gets these human feet and these human legs, it just always feels like she's walking on glass because she's never had legs before. And it's, you know, it's part of like the price that she has to pay for this. And then it's very literal where she's doing this because she wants a soul. And the only way she can get a soul is if she wins the love of a prince. Now this is the part that, if you can bear with me, because it goes in a million angles and I'm going to try to give like a Cliff Notes light version of this. So there's this study that was given to me recently by my friend David Charles Plate, who does Sync Book, and he gets really deep into like movie occultism connections. But he mentioned this paper called The Golden Bough, and The Golden Bough describes this repeating repeating template for old, you know, mythology and folklore. And basically it explains the Disney formula like to a science. And it was written way before Disney existed. So the Golden Bough describes that in order for back in the day, there were so much inbreeding between these royal bloodlines and it became a problem. So in order to make sure that these powerful families didn't keep inbreeding with each other, one of the prince would typically like go undercover. They would put on a mask. They'd become like a warlock or a witch or a monster, or like a Beauty and the Beast is a good example. So the Beast in this case intentionally hides himself and makes himself look like this complete outcast because it is the polar opposite of what a prince might look like, right? So they're kind of like undercover. And the reason that they do this is because they don't only need to wed the princess of some king, they have to kill the king. And that is the true succession of power. And that also ensures the virility of this kind of like passage. And it's because in like a matriarchal society, it wasn't just the king and then his male son gets to rule. It would go through the king's daughter. And because of that, that's what inspires these princes to come from all over the place and dress themselves up and try to win her heart using this completely alternate identity. And this kind of relates to like all of the animal husbandry wedding situations where you've got the Beauty and the Beast and you've got the Princess and the Frog, and you've got all these tales where the prince is hidden. You know, he's changed his ability to be detected by like a commoner. Well, in The Little Mermaid, it's the exact opposite. And it's kind of because Ursula is helping the princess change her appearance and to lure in the prince. And the subtext, if you go by The Golden Bough, it's that in some theoretical mythological endpoint, she also has to kill Prince Eric's father, the king, in order to fully absorb and become this next level that she's looking for. So that's part of it. It's not just that she wants true love. She wants a human soul. She wants her offspring to have human souls. And ultimately, she's going to take over and be, you know, queen of the land, just like Ursula wants to become queen of the sea, right? Because when Ariel goes back down and goes back to Ursula, she holds up this contract. And the second that King Triton signs this contract, she becomes the queen of the sea. So it's, again, it's the princess trying to kill the king, take over the kingdom. There's a lot to unpack there, but man, I'm telling you that it's all here in The Little Mermaid of all stories.
Yeah, I guess they cut the scene where she murders the king from this one.
Well, she kind of shrivels him, right? She turns him into like a little thing, and then they show earlier in that movie that she kind of like grabs those guys and just like snacks on them, or they're like, it's her little garden that she does whatever she wants with. So the concept is that she's eating them, you know, puts them in the garden, they grow, she eats them, which again, in The Golden Bough, that's that is almost a one for one literal translation, where they take the fruit of the land, or they take like the branch, and that's signifying, you know, removing the daughter, or sometimes taking the life of the king in the process.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not even sure how to roll off of that, man. I'm just trying to think of other movies. I don't know. I keep thinking we're going to get to Toy Story before too long, and I keep thinking a little bit about kind of the vibe on Toy Story, where, you know, toys would have no soul. They're made of plastic and becoming, you know, beloved by their owner.
So I want to make an important distinction here. All this talk about not having a soul, this is the occulted aspect. This is the hidden Mickey aspect of this movie, because unless you read the source material, you'd never have any idea that this movie is about this creature that has no soul, that wants a soul, because that would completely upset the Disney proxy formula, right? The Disney proxy is basically saying, not only does this character have a soul, but the lunchbox that has her on the front, that has a soul. And the toy that you get in your Happy Meal, that also has a soul. Like, they're trying to very much let you know that, you know, these fish and all of these little side characters, they all have souls because they essentially replace your parents. That's my Disney proxy theory, right? But I feel like that's the occulted part, because no longer is it about soul. Now it's about love, and it's about true love, and it's about the, you know, Prince Eric states, like, I just haven't found her yet. She's somewhere out there. So he's looking for the perfect love. And then she thinks that she's in love. So again, this is all based on love, but there's really no correlation to that in these previous source materials. It was never about love. It was about wanting a soul, wanting a human soul. And this is where it takes that creepy turn, because again, you've got Sebastian that's helping groom the 16-year-old, like, here, puff out your lips like this, and you know, make this pouty face like this, and sway your hair and really attract him. And then Ursula is giving her tips on, you know, how to attract the man, and they don't want you to talk, you know, like, just kind of look good. So I feel like there's a lot of this weird element of like, you know, using sort of like your sexual abilities as like weaponized. And that's at the core of like the weird Disney programming in this movie, more so than so many others. Can you think of another Disney character outside of Jessica Rabbit that has been as sexualized as Ariel by the source material, not by, you know, people drawing funny sketches and like side material, but like this movie itself? They kind of illustrate Ariel, like, you know, she's like a swimsuit supermodel. They've got like the whipping of the hair and the slow motion and everything.
I don't know if I brought it up before or not, but there is the old cartoon Heathcliff with, and then there's the
you have like brought two, it up before. Yeah, you've got a thing for,
yeah, Heathcliff's the weirdly sexualized. Right? No, I'm just like that scene. That's the other character I can think of that's like weirdly sexualized, right? As far as animation go, because that one is like someone should have noticed before it got animated what they were doing. So I mean, that I think that's the thing with all three examples is, yeah, someone noticed. I mean, with Jessica Rabbit, that's like the joke, right? It's funny, but
yeah, she's not bad, she's drawn that way. So I wanted to mention another story that came up in this Paracelsus. It's tangential to this, but the concept of the water nymphs came from a book that Paracelsus wrote that was about water nymphs and like other creatures. And one of those other creatures was a salamander, and the salamander, and it's anyway, just bear with me. I don't want to get into like how it all connects. Let me just read some of this out. So this is from the salamander story. So he says, who would care to converse with such an ugly beast as a salamander, male or female? You are mistaken. That is merely the idea which ignorant painters and sculptors have of them. Talking about salamanders. He says, salamander women are beautiful, more beautiful even than any of the others, since they are of a purer element. I had not intended to speak about them and was passing briefly over the description of these peoples, since you will see them yourself at your leisure and with ease if you have the curiosity to do so. You'll see their dresses, their food, their manners, their customs, and their laws. The beauty of their intellects will charm you even more than that of their bodies. Yet one cannot help pitying these unfortunate when they tell one that their souls are mortal and they have no hope whatever of eternal enjoyment of the Supreme Being, of whom they have no knowledge and whom they worship reverently. They will tell you they are composed of the purest portions of the element in which they dwell, and that they have in them no impurities whatever, since they are made but one element. Therefore, they die only after several centuries, but what is time in comparison with eternity? So here clearly, Paracelsus is talking about female salamanders, but the female salamander, it almost seems like a stand-in for an elemental, some kind of an elemental nymph. So for the water nymph version, this would be that Melusina. And then he goes on, this is a crazy one, that Paracelsus, he sees they're telling this story where a kid sees a salamander in the fire, like an actual magical salamander, and the dad also sees it, and the dad slaps his kid across the face, and the kid looks at the dad and he's like, "Dad, why did you just hit me?" And he was like, "The only reason I hit you was because, like, to remind you of this moment. This moment is so important because people don't believe that these magical salamanders truly exist. And now by me slapping you across the face, I've basically like implanted this memory, right? This is like this NLP anchoring, but it's just like you smack your kid and you're like, now you're going to remember this forever." And that was this like really interesting aspect where I always find it interesting when they write about mythological creatures, but they always stop themselves to say like, "Hey, I know that people think these aren't real, but this is real. Like there's no, you know, there's no metaphorical story or anything, or at least unless it's like an Inception thing where they're just like burying it. They have that particular shape in these towers in the background. We're talking about, it's like the castle towers, right? Well, there's a functional reason why they're tall and they look like that, but there's also a symbolic reason of why they look like that. Symbolic reason of an obelisk or a dome, right? Those are all sort of sexualized, energized architecture that relate to this whole as above, so below, depending on, you know, what you believe. But I think that the people that make them and the ones that pay for them to be constructed, they do believe it. So they are phallic. So whether or not it looks like a dick, the little castles are dicks. End of story.
Yeah. I guess I mean, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying, I'm wondering if they're trying to show like, King Triton's power or something like that. I mean, he's running around barrel chested as well. What is my note here? Oh, I bet Triton's nipples have the texture of kiln hardened clay, you know, that sort of thing.
It's funny because in some of the ancient cultures that believed in merfolk, like I think there was some Gaelic or really like Druids or something. They believed that in order to show respect to the king, you would suckle the king's teat. So whenever they would try to take a king down, they would cut his nipples off so that even in the afterlife, nobody could suck on his nipples. So therefore, he could never be king again in this life or after.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad I noticed that then.
Interesting. Yeah, if that case ever comes up on trivia night.
Yes, yes. Oh, yeah, you don't need to suck on the king of the nipple. The king of the nipple. I like that. Okay. Actually, that sounds like a really bad, like, frat boy claim, so maybe I don't like that.
So I was making this point earlier, and just to drive it home a little bit, in the Disney movie, Ariel wants to be human, but it's not to have a human soul, because Disney can't not have their main character not have a soul, because otherwise they don't get to sell all the toys that, like, you know, put the kids to sleep at night, and they want their Ariel stuffed animal and they want their Ariel everything. So Ariel has to have a soul. She wants to be a human for all of the mundane human reasons, though. Like, she wants to have feet and she wants to feel what it's like to walk on the ground. And there's some interesting parts of this too, where like everyone that's a human in this movie is eating sea creatures. And I went on this whole rabbit hole of like, what do merfolk eat? Are merfolk vegetarian? And it seems unequivocally that no, they're not vegetarian. I mean, technically they can eat seaweed all the time, but they don't. They eat crabs. I mean, they eat Sebastians and they eat flounders. So, but then that also leads to this interesting moral question of, would a merfolk eating a fish be considered cannibalism? So, and it was, I didn't go too far down that rabbit hole, but it was an interesting one.
Well, I guess like if you eat a chimpanzee, is that, you know, cannibalism?
Indiana Jones again, right?
Yeah. Monkey brains. So
they're maybe not
people in there.
It's an interesting hypothetical. And I had another hypothetical too, just since we're on that note, there's a scene where she's like pretending to eat with them, but you know, clearly she doesn't want to eat any seafood. Cause in this movie, they almost imply that all the merfolk are vegetarian, which has, as far as I can tell, there's no basis in that. That's just like a Disney thing where they don't eat their friends, right? But in reality, she would. But in the context of this Disney movie, she's willing to give up everything, right? She signs this horrible contract with clearly an evil sea witch, like kind of knows what she's getting into, but she signs this contract. And she's willing to give herself up for it, all on the chance that she might not even get this guy at the very end. So I'm just, the hypothetical that's coming here is that in that scene where she saves Sebastian from, you know, the prince's assistant's plate or whatever, if they caught her with Sebastian and they were like, eat it, like eat the crab right now to prove it, I feel like she'd eat Sebastian, because I feel like she's already put so much on the line to the point where that happens, that there wouldn't be sort of a sin in her mind to do that, because she's already done the unspeakable by basically signing her soul over.
Well, it's an interesting thing about dramatization. One, Arrow, I'm going to make a double point here. One, you know, in commercial media, yeah, you can't have the soulless creature as your protagonist, right? In older, you know, especially in older books where it's not necessarily being written to sell a bunch of copies, you can. So that's a big difference. I mean, like you said, there's no way Disney could go about having their protagonist be a soulless creature, you know? The other point is, yeah, once you have followed the eels into the lair, you've made your choice. The rest of it is just for dramatization, right? I know the last Matrix movie, I liked it fine, but a lot of people didn't like it, whatever. But one thing that I thought was really
the video cool is like, the video, you know, game one.
No, this is the one that came out about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, that was the video game one, right? Where like they create these virtual video game worlds.
Oh yeah. Sorry, I thought you were like asking how Enter the Matrix, the video game or something. But
oh yeah, which is funny because the movie is kind of based on the canon that game. Yeah, anyways, it's Inception-y.
I guess the point I was getting to is once you're being offered the red pill or the blue pill, you've already made the choice. There is no choice at that point, you know. No one would ever go the other way, right? Except boy does. And that's part of the thing. But yeah, it's just like, there is no choice once you're that deep, you know?
So she'd eat Sebastian, right? She'd eat Sebastian.
Yeah, she'd eat Sebastian. If she said no, Nurse was probably going to make it happen somehow anyway, right? She's already there.
So this also brings up another really interesting note that it feels like it's so obvious in the plot line, but watching it as an occult Disney, you know, through the lens, they're showing here that a contract is the most powerful thing in the universe. Even King Triton with his trident trying to blast, you know, with all of his magic and energy and might, he's basically the underwater Zeus, right? Even with all of his power and king of the sea, he can't break a contract. The contract is more potent than anything else. And honestly, I can't think of any other versions of mythology outside of, you know, like these Faustian bargains and stuff, but like older mythology, humans and like entities could break contracts all the time. That's actually what starts a lot of beef between humans and gods, is that like someone says they'll do one thing and then doesn't follow through, and they turn into these like Aesop fable type of aspect. But here in the Disney universe, the one that Disney is showing your kids, here's how the world works, they're saying, kids, if you ever sign a contract, that is more powerful than God. Like, even the most powerful magic on the face of this planet, I don't care if you are, you know, King Triton himself, you cannot invalidate a contract. And I just feel like that's such a very strong thing to emphasize. And they do it twice. They do it once when Ariel signs it for the first time, and the scroll that she signs, it immediately turns magical, and like it coils itself up and it kind of like poofs out of existence, as if like there's no way that you can take that back. And then again, when Triton tries to blast it, like she uses it as a shield, Ursula does. And then as soon as he signs it, it takes like a nanosecond for him to go into the king of the sea, into this shriveled little thing. So again, that's Disney telling you that the power of a legal contract, hint, hint, animators, and hint, hint, people that might be recording this in the theater or trying to make bootleg Little Mermaid gear, you know, Disney contracts are more powerful than God. So I just feel like that's a very strong message that they're putting in here.
Despite the popularity, at least in Japan, I am thinking about how much of a Western occult vibe we're looking at here and how much it like wouldn't work, like, say, in East Asia. I know some people who used to teach in Korea, and one of the biggest issues there is a contract is more of a guideline, which, you know, when they were working, that was a bit of an issue sometimes. So contract's basically a guideline. We can negotiate as we go. And then the whole idea of signing your soul off or whatever. I mean, we don't, it's hard to say if Ariel has a soul because of the source material, but you know,
well, like, they call it her voice. They say it's her voice.
Yeah. Okay. Good point. But
there's a soul.
There's, you know, like there's reincarnation. There's always other things, right? So if it doesn't work out this time, it works out another time, which no, here it's, this is it. This is the ultimate, you know,
that's it. Exactly. Yeah. That's a huge underlying point, is that in the original source material too, that if Ariel dies, there is no reincarnation because there is no soul. And therefore she turns into like sea foam, and that's it, that she just never exists again. So it really is putting everything on the line.
Whereas, yeah, and directly from the Japanese perspective, you know, there's the idea that inanimate things have souls. There's the soul of the mountain, you know, that sort of thing. So the original concept just would barely even make sense from an Eastern perspective.
This completely wild tangent, but there's a trash TV show, like a 90 Day Fiance or something, but I remember seeing one recently, and this lady was having a problem because her fiance was from Japan, and she found out that he had been married like 3 or 4 times. But apparently in Japan, like the legality and the seriousness of a divorce is a little bit different than in the Western world, because in Japan it can be one way. Like, both parties do not have to consent for a divorce to go through. So the guy like potentially had like 3 wives and then just like one way divorced them. I don't know if you ever heard of that before. It sounded wild to me, but it kind of backs up what you're saying, is that this concept of a contract having more power than God might be like a Western thing.
And hey, you know, that it might even be the more important thing we're like programming. Cause I mean, grew up in America, we take our contracts quite seriously, right? You know, we as kids, we saw that, you know, the power of King Triton cannot breach the contract. So,
and it's kind of true, but it's almost like currency, right? It's if everyone's just like, that doesn't mean anything. So what? I wrote my name on a piece of paper 20 years ago. What does that mean? But like, you know, humans give it power, because without it, I guess, just civilization turns into absolute chaos. Cause I mean, even a fiat currency, deep down, that origin came from having like a stamp from the king, or it got what they call the tally sticks, right? They'd break the tally stick and it would only match up with the king's tally sticks, and that became burdensome. So they would just like write you like a check that's like, I owe you 20 tally sticks, and sign it. And from that exact moment, it's almost like, you know, the signature becomes this magical thing that has power, and the power is from everyone believing in it. It's like this shared illusion.
Yeah. Our economy is basically based on hopes and dreams. Okay.
So let's turn this into a financial podcast now.
That's right. Wow, I'm like the last person I should ever do that. I remember my growing up, my mom keeps saying, talking about CDs, and I'd get excited about music, you know, which she was talking about banking, right? Still, if someone says CD, I'm like, ooh, what am I going to hear now? I still like CDs. Yeah. That's great. Oh, yeah, I did that. Here's one place it does break down. That just going, when the original Star Wars was released, they did not have the merch ready because that had never happened before. So Christmas 1977, a whole lot of kids got an IOU for Star Wars action figures from their parents. There's like an official sheet or something. I'm like, man, if you're 6 years old, that's still disappointing, you know?
Yeah, like not getting the Cabbage Patch Kids when it came out. They would give you like the little birth certificate or like the adoption form.
Like it's on the way, but you know, kids don't have patience for contracts. Maybe that's what this is trying to teach them. It's so important. Get some patience for it. That's what you need. So,
well, I mean, I really do feel, and I'm biased, but this is Disney telling you contracts are important. If you're watching this movie, contracts are important.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, just since I guess some people do see this on video now, and if you're listening, who cares? But I'm crouched into the screen so weirdly now, so I'm talking as directly into the microphone as I can so it doesn't sound terrible. Just FYI.
This is just the new POV. We're going to do this from now on.
This is the new POV. You're now going to get a weird side profile of me for these or something. I don't know. I'll work out my text later. I'm looking through my notes, and I'm mostly just writing like entertainingly snarky stuff.
Let's hear it. Let's get some snark out there.
Oh, let's see. Dingle Blatting made it to the new version. Snarf Blat did not, for whatever. Oh, because that's the pipe. That's why. Okay, there's no smoking. They did cut out. I guess I should make a few observations on 2023. That's what some of my notes are about. Yeah, they cut out. I think they cut out the cooking scene where
I have a note on this one, because in the cooking scene in the animation, they portray the chef as like the ultimate bad guy. It reminds me of the Brave Little Toaster, where the guy that runs the repair shop is seen as this horrible monster that's like disfiguring and mutilating, you know, these secondhand appliances. And again, here we've got the chef, but as I'm watching this, it's like, if this only makes sense if everyone in the movie is a vegetarian, because otherwise all the chef is doing the entire movie is cooking food. Like, he doesn't do a single thing that's out of character or nefarious or malicious. All he's doing is cooking food, and he sees that there's a live crab in his kitchen and he cooks seafood all day. Like, there's absolutely nothing that I kind of see like bad about that particular character. So I don't know. I understand maybe cutting him. It might have been a little bit too scary, but also I don't know if Disney is promoting vegetarianism yet or not.
And I should note, like Jiminy Cricket in the new Pinocchio, Sebastian is now rendered like completely terrifying in this quote unquote live action version. So they're taking their cute characters and turning them into like abominations, you know, getting back to the Anunnaki genetic engineering vibe, I guess. The other big popular occult thing. We have to talk about the priest's erection, don't we?
Oh yeah, I guess so. Sure.
I mean, people would be like, "Oh, they didn't talk about that. What's up?" So I don't know. Disney says no, that's a knee. So
I mean, if it's what's the stupid? Is it a white and gold dress or is it a blue and gold dress? I forgot what the thing was, but it's like, it is whatever you want it to be at this point. To me, it's always going to be a dick. Like, the priest is always going to have a hard on.
The priest always has a hard on. No, I actually missed it. I was looking for it by watching last night, and I missed the shot. So
it happens quick. I don't know if they've edited it out. I don't think they did, but it happens really quick. It's like a very minor, have to pause the frame to see it kind of thing.
Okay. I definitely did not have the, patience for that.
It's not quite on Rescuers level where you literally have to have like the laser disc and pause it at a frame rate that most people didn't have at the point, but it, you know, so it's a little bit easier to see. I do think it's a dick. Yeah, I mean, whatever.
Fortunately, they were able to include that in the 2023 movie. So.
Oh, they also have a dick in the live action?
Oh, no, they don't. Well, I don't know. Maybe they do, and I didn't notice, but...
you got to get the laser disc and freeze frame it.
That's right. That's right. What else do I got here? Let's see. Prince Eric sucks at charades. It was, I don't know. I guess there's, you can't believe the impossible so easily, but he should have been better at charades than he was. Oh, yes. Okay. Here's something the first time noticed watching it last night. Did the boat have a giant veiled statue on deck for like the entire voyage? Because they have the giant statue of Prince Eric.
When he unveils it at the very beginning. I suppose so. Yeah. But the way that he unveils it, it almost seems like someone had been working on it and it's been like hidden this whole time. Yeah.
I guess they did transport statues on tall ships. But I just like the idea that there's, hey, what's that? You know, for like 6 weeks or whatever.
And then they finally unveiled at the very end.
Yes, yes. There's the fan theory, which I always like too, that the shipwreck Ariel is exploring is the Frozen girl's parents' shipwreck. I like that little tied continuity bit.
I didn't even know that Elsa. I didn't know that her parents died in a shipwreck.
Yeah, in the beginning of Frozen, it shows that Anna and Elsa's parents died in a shipwreck, and it looks. You know, it's a tall ship. So the fan theory is, oh, that's the ship that Ariel's exploring, which I kind of like.
I like it. Yeah.
That's kind of fun. That pretty much does like, you know, most of my notes. Did you have anything else you wanted to throw out?
I've got a few more. Yeah.
Go for it. Go for it.
So kiss the girl. Where let's not even talk about again. It's a little bit creepy because it's an 18-year-old legal adult. But anyways, this scene is interesting to me because they imply that animals can understand humans, like they understand English. So first of all, does that mean that all animals always have understood in the context of this movie? Animals have always understood humans, and they just ignore us, which is kind of a dick move. As a whole on all of animals.
But yeah, that makes sense.
But on top of that, humans can hear animals, and there's no longer a magical connection where Ariel can talk to animals, just like every other Disney protagonist has this magical ability to talk to animals. But in the Kiss the Girl scene, Sebastian and other fish and other like ducks or something, they're singing, and Prince Eric can hear them clearly because they're saying like kiss the girl and all these different like subliminal mess. They're literally giving him subliminal messages, right? There's a Disney movie about teaching a legal adult male to kiss this under. Anyways, the concept here is that animals are super dicks because they can talk to us if they wanted, and they can hear us and follow our instructions if they wanted. They just don't do either of those things. They only listen to Ariel and other merfolk or something, I guess. So it's just a weird little continuity thing, but it just made me think, like, are all Disney animals dicks? And they're all magical, and they're just choosing to gaslight everybody except for like Snow White or, you know, take your pick. And then they'll talk to them, but then pretend like they can't talk anymore.
Well, they're all subjects of King Triton, who has ruled that we do not talk to the humans. So he's a dick, right?
Everyone is cowering
under his power, but not as much as a contract.
Right. Again, dude, the contract is more powerful than God.
Animals take nothing more seriously than contracts, I'm sure.
And so out of context, here's some lyrics from Kiss the Girl. Boy, you better do it soon. She won't say a word. That's from that song.
Okay.
And then when she gets back, Ursula immediately calls Ariel a little tramp. And then she goes, ah, she's better than I thought. Like, she's luring this human in with her, you know, sexual energy. And then she immediately grabs a butterfly and smashes the butterfly into the fire. And that's like this evil magic spell that she's like casting. And I mean, I can't not put Project Monarch Disney programming in here, because out of all the things that she could have done, it's a butterfly. So anyways, there's a potential Monarch connection, although as far as I'm aware, most Monarch information didn't come out until the mid to late 90s, not in 89. So if anything, maybe Disney had, you know, predictive programming here.
And I feel like Mariah Carey really popularized that among others, but yeah. that's my first go-to, I guess, when I'm just thinking of, like, you know, obvious 90s Monarchs. I mean, and, you know, and style and substance, however you want to go about it. So
it was a huge motif, and it kind of continues to be. And then I had one other note here, and it's weird that Prince Eric is seen as like the guy when he falls in love with the voice, and not, you know, like, he doesn't trust his eyes. He doesn't trust the actual love, right? He falls in love with the voice that Ariel gives up, which obviously plays into the irony, but I think it's also has to do with that golden bough aspect where it's almost like the prince wants the soul, because Disney has inverted the story where it's no longer the soulless mermaid that needs to find a human soul, because you can't sell the toy without the soul. Again, like the Toy Story, they want inanimate objects to have souls. So of course the protagonist has to have a soul. So in this case, they flip that and it's Eric that doesn't have the soul. And that's why he's fascinated by the voice. And all he cares about is his voice following it around, because the voice represents Ariel's soul. So I feel like it's an inversion of this like mythological archetype.
To be fair, he is being a bit mind controlled at that point as well. So, I mean, cause he's completely out of it, you know, the next couple scenes.
What? And also the mermaids, right? The traditional role of the mermaid was that they would kind of hypnotize you into this. And to put a little feather in the cap, the original story of the Little Mermaid, she does not convince, I'll call him Prince Eric, I don't think his name has always been Prince Eric, but she does not convince the prince to fall in love. And therefore she does end up perhaps returning to Seafoam. And there's the happy ending version of this is that her sisters all come to her and they bring her a dagger and they tell him, you have to kill the prince and drip his blood on your feet. And then you can turn back into this mermaid and like undo this spell. And she actually goes to do it. And at the last second, she can't bring herself to murder the prince. And because she doesn't kill him and put his blood on her feet, then she basically is granted a soul. It's like, oh man, this act of, you know, morality proves that you deserve the soul after all. So she kind of gets it, and that's the happy ending. But man, what a gruesome story. Is that potentially it would have ended with her murdering the prince and then putting his blood on her feet, which again, I have to bring back to Paracelsus, because some of the original stories about having magic of homunculi, being able to walk on water, being able to breathe underwater, involve taking this mythological being, killing it, and putting its blood on your feet. I'm not making that up. I've got proof.
Well,
it's right here. It's right here in the Homunculus Owner's Manual. I think there's even an exact panel about someone dripping blood on their feet in order to do something magical. So it's in there. It's so long. It's so long. I can't even find. Oh, that's it right there.
Okay. Oh, that's a lot of blood.
You can
okay.
feed a homunculus blood and milk for 40 days in the dark, after which his blood can be used to anoint your feet, to walk on water, and a number of other miracles. This is from research from Paracelsus.
Okay. I don't know. Should I just dovetail that into how do we get that?
Oh, you can get that at paranoidamerican.com, along with a whole bunch of other cool, interesting things that you'll only find at paranoidamerican.com. That's the Homunculus Owner's Manual. Oh.
There we go. We call it Disney. We also hang out on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it.
Facebook. Don't dead name Twitter. It's X now.
Yeah. Well, the artist formerly known as Twitter is the best name to use, I think. So that's what I usually go with. But yeah, I called Disney Pod there. And then I put episodes a little early up on the Patreon podcastio.
This was a really fun one. Highly recommended. I think the movie on its own merit is a good movie. Not a fan of all of the songs. Some people love them. Under the Sea is an awesome song, I think.
Yeah, that deserves its award.
Rewatch this. Consider that Ariel isn't supposed to have a soul, but now invert that and read The Golden Bough about having to kill the king in order to take the princess and invert that. And I just feel like Disney at this point has become experts in the occultism. So now they can have fun with it. Now they can start inverting stuff and tweaking the rules. Like what's that adage that I'm about to butcher, but it's like, you can't break the rules until you master them. I think that's sort of the cusp of where Disney's at right now. They've mastered animation styles. They've mastered the art of storytelling, at least from the Grimm perspective of taking these ancient, you know, Germanic tales and then turning them into modern times. But now it's also like, and we're going to sell lots of merch. And here's how we do that. It's through these occult symbolism and teaching kids that contracts are important and giving our protagonists souls and making sure that we immediately abandon all parental figures. And this one, she voluntarily leaves, right? She runs away from home, but it's still the removal of the authority figure. There's no authority figure in this movie except for her sidekicks, Sebastian and Flounder, which inevitably become, you know, like the popular little plush animals and Happy Meal toys that go along with it. So Disney proxy in full effect.
Right on. And hey, let's face it, kind of makes the movie better when you watch it with interesting lenses, you know?
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the reproductive rights amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.